In Monty Python's classic, The Life of Brian, Brian, whose whose life in funny ways sort of the life of Jesus, is against the Romans. And he begins by saying, "What have the Romans ever done for us?" And then somebody in the crowd says, "Well, they built us the aqueducts." "This is okay, but what else have the Romans done for us?" "Well, the roads, those are nice." And then the scene plays out, and they list a long list of amenities that Roman occupation can bring to a backwater place like Palestine. And it's the aqueducts that I'm interested in. You may not have known this, but Pontius Pilate actually built aqueducts to supply Jerusalem with more water, something that it desperately needed during his time as governor. And you probably do know this, aqueducts are expensive. There's a lot of material involved and some engineering and logistics and whatever else they needed. So that raises the question, how do you pay for this? Now, this was about 20 years or so before the Judean economy started rotting from the inside, but it isn't exactly a wealthy area in the first century. Except there was one institution that was by far the wealthiest in the region, and that is the temple treasury. So Pontius Pilate took the cash, actually it was probably gold and some other valuables, from the temple treasury to pay for the aqueducts. As you might imagine, that's not kosher. But that raises some other questions. Now, the average person freaked out, and they formed basically a mob, and they threatened a riot. And Pontius Pilate, in response to this threat, ordered a whole bunch of his own soldiers to dress up like Judean men, infiltrate that group, bring blunt objects like clubs that they could carry with them, and then when the time was right, you can probably figure out what was next. Brutal. Except there's one thing that doesn't make a lot of sense. The entire time that Pontius Pilate was governor, there was only one high priest, Caiaphas, whom you may remember from the New Testament. And that's weird because the high priest would be chosen every year. It was entirely within Pilate's authority to select the high priest. The Greeks actually figured it out before the Romans that if you control who's the high priest, you can exert a fair amount of control over the Jewish people. And it wasn't until Pontius Pilate was deposed, which we'll talk about in a minute, that Caiaphas lost his position. And the reason why that's weird is that he looted the temple treasury. And yet the high priest who's responsible for the whole thing kept his job. Now that's not a smoking gun, but that gun barrel's kind of warm. Something's going on there. I think the point where that gun barrel proverbially smokes is the fact that once Pilate is out, Caiaphas loses his job. There is some kind of manipulation happening there. Now, already this paints Caiaphas, or not Pontius Pilate,
in a certain
light. Somebody who's smart enough and manipulative enough to figure out how to get things done his way, regardless of what or who may stand in his way. And he is not above using extreme and horrific violence in ways that quite literally are against the Geneva Convention today. And that really stumps Pilate up. We don't know a lot about him, but what we do know of him is somebody who is vicious, brutally violent, a master manipulator, but also someone who kept his job as governor for a pretty long time. Now, eventually, 4 to 6-ish years after his interaction with Jesus, the dates are kind of tricky. There will be a Samaritan rebellion about 30 miles north of Jerusalem. And Pilate will put that rebellion down so brutally that he gets recalled by Caesar. If you do something so violently that Rome itself thinks you crossed a line, you have a problem. It would be like the late, great Robin Williams telling somebody, you have too much energy, you need to calm down. Because that man was like a squirrel. Now, the reason why this is important is that these certain qualities will help us understand one very short moment as he's interacting with Jesus. But we'll get to that in a second. The scene you may well know quite well is that the chief priests, who are really ultimately responsible for Jesus' death, have recognized that Jesus has significant following. And really, if what he's saying is true about himself, they are out of a job. And people tend not to like to lose power, especially if you're a high priest or a chief priest, because with that power comes gobs of cash. And so they realize they need to get him axed. Now, Pilate is in Jerusalem because it's Passover. Normally he lives up in Caesarea, kind of northwest, a nice coastal town. But he's in Jerusalem because all of the Jewish people are from slavery in Egypt. And if anything ever were to pop off, it was probably going to be then. It would be like, and just go with it for the moment, if the United States was occupied by Canada for some reason, they would, you better believe, get real nervous around the 4th of July. Does that make sense? So Pilate will come down to Fortress Antonia, and he is the one who chooses the high priest. He is the one that actually retains custody of the high priestly garments and only gives them to him at the right time, just so that he knows who's in charge. And then they come knocking at his door saying, hey, Pilate, this guy, he thinks he's a king. Now, that is potentially something that Pilate would be worried about. Because if they have a guy going around saying, I'm the king of the Jews, rise up, now's our time, that's going to cut against Roman interests, and in fact, that happened. So the premise works. But if you read carefully the Gospels and the way Pilate interacts with them, you can tell he's just kind of over it after about 2 minutes. There's a certain kind of reluctance, and sometimes people would say, well, that makes him the good guy. Trust me, he's not a good guy. I think he's just busy. And I think the tone of his responses should be understood more like a, guys, this is a busy time. Can you please not bother me with some internal Jewish debate? I don't care. But if this guy is saying he's a king, then I've got to at least talk to him. So he asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus kind of responds with some more questions. Maybe not the best strategy if your goal is to not be killed. But eventually Jesus says, yeah, I'm a king, but my kingdom is not of this world. It doesn't originate in this world. Because if it were, my servants would be fighting to keep me from being handed over. That's airtight logic. And at that point, Pilate, he's kind of done with this. He wants to kick it back to them. Now, something you got to know, and many of you probably do, is that when you have somebody like Pilate, who has immense amount of power, and is very able to get what he wants in the worst possible sense. He is not above brutality and violence and manipulation. That those types have, shall we say, a very tenuous at best relationship with the truth. Think of the great dictators of our time. And by great, I don't mean like good. I mean awful, but great. Like Stalin, Hitler, Gaddafi, Kim Jong-un, and so on. They have, or had, immense amount of power. And none of them hesitated to use violence to get what they wanted. And I would trust absolutely none of them if they were telling me that the sky was blue. Because that's part of the deal. What's actually true doesn't matter when you hold all of the cards. Now, eventually, they're going back and forth. Jesus is going to... He's going to do a couple of power moves, power plays, if you will. There'll come a point where Pilate is talking and kind of puffing his chest out, saying, don't you know that I have the power to order you killed? And Jesus, and he's not wrong, says, yeah, you wouldn't have that power unless it was given to you. So who really has the power? I inserted that last part. There will be another moment, actually, in our readings in a little bit, where he is talking to Jesus, and Jesus is just quiet. He says nothing. That's a power move. I don't know if you've ever seen, or hopefully not, been involved in a big argument where somebody is just blowing up at somebody else, and the other person is just quiet and cool. In that exchange, who's in charge? Quiet one. Now, those are big moments, but this is pretty relatable. We as human beings like to get our way. We like to have control. And sometimes we will exert control in different ways. Like, for example, in a relationship, the passive one usually has the most power. Really dumb example, if someone says, hey, Eric, let's go to dinner, and I say, great, and they say, where do you want to go? And I say, you choose. Who has the power there? I do, because I'm making them choose. Now, that's a dumb example, but in relationships, this can be a problem. To say the least. It's the person who's always saying no that holds all the cards. And it's uncomfortable to think about, but really the difference between us and somebody like Pontius Pilate is scale. It's pretty human impulse. We like to get our way. And we probably all know people, and if we're willing to be courageous, we probably can see within ourselves a tendency, a desire to get our way. Now, as I said, you have somebody who enjoys a certain amount of power. We can scale this down to, you know, us-sized, because there's always a power dynamic in relationships and in society. But thinking back to Pontius Pilate, he is not going to be that interested in what's actually true. He only cares about his own interests. And whatever those happen to be are true. So on the night that, or the day when he's interacting with Jesus, the only thing he cares about is, are you a threat to Rome? No. Okay. Until Caiaphas, his buddy, I think, starts pushing. And all of this leads to a very interesting question. Jesus says that he is of the truth. And people who are of the truth listen to his voice. And Pontius Pilate responds with, what is truth? We should not understand that question as a sincere inquiry into this concept of truth. Pontius Pilate is not thinking, let's bring out some Plato, and I think Aristotle talks a little bit about this. Let's have a conversation about the good, the true, the beautiful, or whatever. No. This should be understood in the most derisive tone you can come up with. Because Pilate doesn't care what's true. Because all he knows is power and manipulation, coercion. In fact, I wouldn't put it past him to say something like, the only truth I know or care about is at the tip of a spear. Or in modern terms, the only truth I know about comes out of the barrel of a gun or is dropped by a drone. Violence. Because somebody like Pilate doesn't care. Now, when Jesus talks about truth, that's perhaps a different question. What does he mean by that? Have you ever thought about it? What does Jesus mean when he says, I'm of the truth, or people of the truth listen to my voice? What does he mean by truth? Because there are ways that we can talk about truth, and a lot of them don't really fit. Like, do we mean like true, like probably more years now than I care to remember, like way back when I was studying mathematics at Georgia Tech? You know, there was axiomatic truth, or a theorem can be proven true. I don't think that's what Jesus means. So what does Jesus mean when he identifies himself with truth? Pilate, of course, is simply thinking in terms of expediency. What is going to accomplish my goal? That's the only truth I care about. And right now, my goal is to get all of these people to leave me alone. But what does Jesus mean? Now that's a question for philosophy and theology. And there's a lot of different ways that we can answer it. And most of those ways are honestly pretty boring. So we're not going to. But there is one way. that is, in my estimation, better. And it comes to the idea of how do you know God? Or to put it in a different way, how does God reveal God's self to us? And that, again, has a whole bunch of different ways to answer it. And again, a lot of them are really boring. You can spend some time and go to seminary to learn. I don't recommend it, though. It's just not worth it. But I think the best way to answer that question, the question of how does God reveal God's self to us, is to look at what God does. It's kind of like you can understand somebody to an extent by what they say, but definitely by what they do. Or as the saying goes, actions speak louder than words. So what does God do? Well, in a deep irony, as John is narrating this story, as the T word has been tossed out and then by Pilate just thrown to the gutter because he has no use for that kind of thing, Jesus is about to answer that question. And in the great irony, it's Pontius Pilate who is going to sign the order for that to happen. Amen.